Our first case, Gabanelli v. Gabanelli. Mr. Borsha.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jim Borsha. I represent Tito Gabanelli Ubaldo, Elio Gabanelli, who I'll refer to as Elio in this matter. We're here today because the district court in this case improperly granted summary judgment to the plaintiff in this case. The summary judgment was granted based upon procedural technicalities, not on the merits of the case. And this court has a longstanding viewpoint that is a policy of the court that cases should be decided based upon their merits and not on procedural technicalities.
Well, we do have that rule, but on the other hand, Rule 36 sets forth the way in which requests for admission are supposed to be treated. By my study of the record, U.S. counsel, which I guess is you, is retained in October 2005. The district court doesn't finally grant summary judgment on the merits until February 2008, and the motion to withdraw the admissions doesn't come until June 2007. And, you know, courts can't really do their business if people don't follow the procedures that are set out. Requests for admission are a very useful tool in discovery.
That's correct. There are some reasons for that. The first reason is that when we were retained in the case, the request to admit or even file more than 30 days before that and had not been responded to.
No, I understand that, but it seems to me the district court might have viewed your request more favorably if the minute you were retained, you had come in and said, you know, Elio was not represented before this. There was this rather informal letter that somehow he piggybacked on or was part of. But we would like to contest some or all of these propositions.
And I guess one of the reasons was we did not want to highlight the issue of the request to admit at that point in time. Our position was they were not properly served. There was no Rule 26 conference. The request to admit were served before the Rule 26 conference. They were served in English, not in Italian.
I'm sure, service rules when litigation is taking place in another country, you're really talking at this point about the evidence part of a case, not service of process. And the Supreme Court held decades ago, in the mid-80s, that the Hague Service Convention is not mandatory vis-a-vis parties. If the Hague Service Convention provisions, if the Hague Evidence Conventions had been used, then they would have been translated into Italian. But there's no requirement to do that.
I think the important thing here is that there was no change in the position of the parties between the time we got into the case and could have filed that motion and the time the court granted or denied the motion with respect to the request to admit. There was a jurisdictional issue that the court wanted us to address first. And the jurisdictional issue was on the summary judgment is, did the court even have jurisdiction? The court had previously ruled.
Let me ask you about that. This agreement with the arbitration clause, is that a translation or is that the original agreement or what?
That is a translation. And actually, there are two translations that we have for that agreement.
Two translations.
Well, there's two different
translations?
Yes.
Well,
is there
some authoritative document, or do the parties agree on what is a correct English translation?
Parties did not agree, so each submitted their own English translation to the agreement.
And is the Italian original in the record?
I believe so, Your Honor. But that agreement provided for disputes between the parties related to these marks to be decided in arbitration.
Now, when did you first invoke arbitration?
I believe that was first invoked when we got into the case, Your Honor, but it was...
What date? I mean, not the exact date. What month and year?
I thought it was started in Italy before you were in the case.
Well, the arbitration actually was commenced. Each side did pick an arbitrator. But
when?
There was no... That was back in... get that, Your Honor. I'm not sure the exact date, actually. I think it is in the record, but it is the agreement in 99, and there were disputes after that. So it was soon after that 99 agreement where there were disputes.
Now, so the mode of invoking arbitration is to appoint your, you know, party arbitrator, is that right?
There were three arbitrators to be appointed, one by each side.
Yes, right. So how do you start? Do you serve a notice that you're want arbitration, or do you just appoint your arbitrator, or what?
I believe each side selected an arbitrator and sent a letter to the other side appointing their arbitrator.
The third was never appointed.
So was there, I think what Judge Posner is asking is, was there a letter sent by one side to the other saying, we are invoking the arbitration clause?
Yes, it's attested by Mr. Yes, by Elio in his affidavit.
And when was that?
I'm not sure.
Well, that's kind of important, actually.
Yeah, actually, neither side just suggested it occurs between 99 and 02, right?
Correct.
Sometime.
Correct.
But there's no fixed.
Correct.
So we're just left with.
It's not clear the exact date.
Now, these two are party arbitrators. Have they ever appointed the neutral arbitrator?
They have not.
Well, what's going on?
Well,
how can you argue that there's no jurisdiction when this arbitration has never gotten going?
Well, it's our position that it's not our fault the reason it's not gotten going. We appointed.
If you want arbitration, you have to do something. If the two-party arbitrators don't appoint someone, you have to do something about it. Ask a court to order them to. Why can't they get together and agree on a third arbitrator?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. It has to do with Italy. But I think the important point here is not just...
It's not an important... Look, you can't just have a situation where the parties sit on their rear ends for a decade and say, oh, well, you know, arbitration, that's the only way this can be resolved, so go away. All you have to do is tell your arbitrator, don't agree on a neutral arbitrator, and then complete paralysis. That's your position.
But it's not just that there was an arbitration clause, but it also provided, the agreement provided, the dispute would be resolved in Italy in the Italian language. And what happened here was there was a prior dispute between the parties.
It's supposed to be resolved in Italy, in arbitration, in Italian, and so on. But you never did anything to get the thing arbitrated.
Well, we did select
an
arbitrator.
How did the Italian court proceedings relate to the arbitration? Because it seems to me all sorts of things are getting filed in the court of Ancona at the same time. Did that court supersede the arbitration somehow? I mean, I happen to know that Italy has an arbitration law. You can go to an Italian court and ask for an order in aid of arbitration.
Yes.
But the court, in the meantime, the court in Ancona was proceeding with the case. And
correct. There were other issues besides just the trademark issues that were being litigated between the parties.
But I just want to put a marker in here. You are labeling this as a jurisdictional argument, and there is no authority that I know of that says that a choice of forum clause, whether it's a choice of an arbitral forum or whether it's a choice of a foreign court forum, is a matter that goes to the court's jurisdiction. We tend to treat it analogously to a venue provision. It's waivable in U.S. courts. It has nothing to do with whether the Lanham Act is involved in this case or whether there's diversity of jurisdiction or anything. So I really have trouble seeing this as a jurisdictional point.
Well, that may be. The district court actually did suggest that it would not have jurisdiction at first until...
Well, I don't think it was right, if that's what it said.
Well, until the proceedings were determined in Italy. And, of course, that was never done before the district court ruled.
Look, parallel litigation does happen in today's world, where there'll be a case in country A and a case in country B at the same time. And it doesn't classically divest the courts in either country of jurisdiction. It can certainly put the parties in an awkward position, as you may be in, if the Italian court says you've got certain rights and the U.S. court says you don't have those rights. But it's not jurisdictional. But maybe it's comedy, maybe it's abstention, maybe it's something else, but it's not jurisdiction.
I think this case, the important point is the plaintiff here agreed in that agreement with respect to these trademarks that disputes arising from that agreement would be litigated in arbitration.
What was the nature of your last suit in Italy? What was that about?
The fifth proceeding, Your Honor, I believe that was dealing with the actual U.S. trademarks.
It
dealt with the U.S. trademarks here, because what happened was after.
Now, would that have been subject to the arbitration clause?
Absolutely.
Well, but I don't understand. You say the only way a dispute can be resolved in arbitration, then you bring a lawsuit.
Well, because the arbitration wasn't proceeding, and what happened after, before that time is
well,
the plaintiff
whether it's proceeding or not proceeding, how can you argue that the arbitration clause bars any other court from, you know, any court from dealing with the issue, and then you go ahead and bring a lawsuit?
Before that we brought the lawsuit, the plaintiff filed a lawsuit here and brought the matter here. Before that, the Ancona court had ruled in our favor on a website issue that we feel is related to the trademark issue.
That's the 1999?
Yes. So the plaintiff, after receiving that ruling, comes to the United States and tries to get this court, or first filed in Texas, to rule on the trademark issues. Because the arbitration wasn't proceeding, our client filed the case in Italy, and that case was consolidated with the 99 proceeding, with the prior proceeding. So that proceeding actually consolidated all the matters together.
I don't
together.
See how you can sue in you can sue in a court and then use the arbitration clause to block the other side from suing. I don't get that.
Well, I think it's because it's our position that the arbitration stalled not for our fault. We selected the arbitrator. The third arbitrator had not been
well,
selected.
You certainly dragged your heels. You've waiting around 10 years for the arbitration to begin. Are you saying you had no remedy? There's no method by which you could speed up the arbitration?
Well, there could have been, Your Honor. I'm not sure all the Italian intricacies in terms of what you could have done there. I don't know Italian law on that. But,
but client is Italian.
Correct.
Well, don't they have lawyers in Italy?
They do.
Well, why doesn't he consult an Italian lawyer, or you consult an Italian lawyer, about how to expedite an arbitration proceeding?
I think the important point here, Your Honor, is that the case should not have been filed here in the first place, it's our view, but it was filed here. There were circumstances that went on in terms of why the requests to admit were not answered at first. But the bottom line is we did eventually respond to the request to admit. We did submit an affidavit. There were fact questions here of substance. This is a longstanding dispute between these parties in terms of who has the rights to these marks. And the trial court ignored that and just ruled on the request to admit. The standards for even allowing late admission, if they were served properly, are, first of all, would it facilitate the merits of the case?
I didn't understand your answer to the original question. Now, why is it that you were tardy in responding to the discovery request about the admissions?
When we first got involved in the case, the client was already tardy. The request to admit had been served back in May of 2005.
When you got admitted, because you got involved, what was the situation?
We were retained, I believe, in October of 2007. The request to admit were served more than, I believe, 5 months before that.
2005.
I'm sorry, 2005, October 2005.
You were retained October 2005. Right, that's what you said.
Yes.
And then what? And then
the requests for admission had been filed long before that.
They had been filed back in, I believe, May of 2005. And there were also prior requests to admit that were served back in 2002.
Back in 2002.
Correct.
That's right. And then they were reserved
which we were
in
not
May
aware
2005.
Of. Right, which we were not aware of.
Anyway, you looked at it, it was too late already.
Correct. That's we at that point.
Until June 2007?
Well,
you waited almost 2 years?
There was the court asked us to address jurisdiction first. And the jurisdictional issue was briefed and the summary judgment was not decided until 2007.
When was the jurisdictional issue decided?
So I believe it was.
I think it was decided in February 2007.
February 2007.
So there's still another few months that go by before you move to withdraw the admissions. Not many, from
Correct.
February to June.
But the point is, there is no prejudice to the plaintiff in the tardy responses to admission. It's not as if they have a witness who they say they can't testify to now. The same responses, and in fact, the same arguments they knew of were going on in Italy before that. They knew that these were contested issues. They knew that we contested, our client contested, that they were the prior owner of the marks here in the United States and that the plaintiff was actually a distributor of theirs and that there was no harm, no foul with respect to the tardy request.
But why did you wait, 4 months to move to withdraw the admissions?
Well, because it was, first, our position, they were not properly served. But secondly, we did not want to highlight the issue.
What is that about? You don't want to highlight.
Well, there was no. At that point in time, they were well more than 30 days behind what the schedule was, and we did not want to draw attention to that point.
Well, wait a second. Are you saying? Wait a minute. You can't. You're saying that if you miss a deadline, the best thing is not to file as soon as possible, but never file in the hope that the court will not notice that you missed the deadline? Is that what you're saying?
No, it was our position that they were not properly filed.
No. This is your second point about highlight. You didn't want to highlight?
Well, at that point in time, they were well more than 30 days behind what they were.
Look, but if you miss something by 30 days, that doesn't mean you can take 10 years and then said, well, since we missed the 30-day deadline, we figured, well, just take our time.
But there was no prejudice to the plaintiff with respect to the delay. I mean, there was not any. They knew, before they served the request to admit, they knew that these were contested issues.
I don't know what they'd know.
Well, they knew because the case was going on in Italy.
You've just been retained, right?
Well, but
how did they know what you were going to do?
Well, because in Italy.
In Italy, yes, but now they're in the United States with a lawyer for the first time and so on. How would they know it?
Same issues were being litigated in Italy, and the same arguments were being made that who had ownership rights, who had priority
to
rights.
To the U.S., not the
Correct.
Italian.
Correct. They knew that.
Have you ever produced a documents establishing a chain of title for these trademarks?
Yes, that's in Mr. Giavinelli's affidavit, and there's attachments to that.
Documents, not an affidavit.
There are documents attached
to
his affidavit. Yes. I think I'm past my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Borsha. Mr. Matheny?
May it please the Court. My name is Anthony Matheny, and along with Herb Finn, I represent Giavinelli Accordions, the appellee in this case. I want to address one issue that came up right at the end there, Your Honor. There are no documents in the record that shows a chain of title of any trademarks in Italy. The affidavit submitted, which is improper, has documents attached to it, but it never shows the chain of title that is laid out by that affidavit or declaration or improper declaration showing transfer of these rights going back to 1930 as alleged in the affidavit. So there is nothing in the record to that effect at all.
But you know what worries me about this case is that it really is a classic instance of parallel litigation. The same case, functionally, is going on in the Italian courts as is going on here. The case gets put on hold for a few years. The Southern District of Texas filing is January 2002. Then it gets transferred here. The stay isn't lifted until May 2005. And in the meantime, there are these various filings and this, what I regard as something of a red herring about jurisdiction. It's too bad people weren't talking about the actual issues, which are whether it's a convenient forum or whether there should be some comedy or whether, you know, how one coordinates the parallel litigation when exactly the same issues are before both courts and there are now conflicting rulings from the two courts, which is always a bad outcome. So I don't see why this, you know, it seems like the district court all of a sudden became impatient with the case and decides to deny the request to withdraw the admissions. It's filed June 2007, 4 months after the partial summary judgment. Or 3 months or so, 3 or 4 months. And so we have these bizarre admissions that are inconsistent with lots of other things in the record.
That's a somewhat fair assessment of what has happened over the past 8 or 9 years, Your Honor. I would say that there are some things that I can clear up and that are in the record with
sure,
a lot of what you
ahead.
Said. I think the best thing to do is to start in the beginning as to what really happened between these parties in Italy and in the United States. There was a dispute in the late 90s between the parties. There was an agreement in 1999 that settled the dispute between the parties.
That's the Internet site.
It had to do with the domain name. It had to do with there were really two issues there. It had to do with the domain name. It had to do with buying a certain product from Elio in Italy and importing it into the United States. And it had to do with a Italian trademark registration that my client owns.
Right. And actually, there's a point of terminology here that I think I want to make. In your brief, you refer repeatedly to counterfeit accordions. But normally, in the trade, these would be regarded as more gray market accordions and counterfeits. It's not like some completely unrelated company with no rights to anything built the accordions. And I mean, it's not like the Rolex watches that you're going to buy on, you know, Ninth Avenue that, you know, were not made by anybody anyone's ever heard of. It's the flow of the accordions from Italy into the United States, perhaps through Master Sound or through somebody, that's really at issue here, and whether under the U.S. trademark the Italian party has the right to sell those accordions here.
I would respectfully disagree with that statement. The counterfeit, as defined by the Lanham Act, states that if any item comes in that is covered by a U.S. registration that is identical to the goods that we sell with that registration, and it has our mark on it, and people believe that it is somehow authorized by us, that is a counterfeit. We do not authorize anything coming to the United States.
No, I understand that, but there are regulations, and there's a fair amount of law that distinguishes within that category between genuine things that aren't authorized to be sold under the U.S. trademark, trademarks being national, and completely phony things.
I believe it is
a lot of there are a lot of cases about that.
I agree.
The Cabbage Patch dolls that were made in Spain that had Spanish adoption papers and so on.
I'm not disagreeing with that fact, but I would say that in this case, the goods are counterfeit. They absolutely are.
They're not made by Ulio Gabinelli's company, right?
Sure, but as soon as they get to customs, this is not in the record, but as soon as they get to customs can seize those because they have a trademark.
I know. I mean, there are remedies for gray market goods as well. Sure. I don't disagree with that at all.
But we have no control over what Ilio is making in Italy. We have no control of where he's sending them. We have no control over what he's telling people except for enforcing our trademark rights. And if we had any kind of control, then you might get to a gray market good.
No. The gray market doesn't assume that. Anyway, that's a sort of a sideline. You were saying, you know, there's this settlement over the www.gabinelli and also how Ilio, if at all, could market in the U.S. And there's a settlement in 99.
That's correct. And subsequent
in
to
the Ancona court.
Yes. Subsequent to that 1999 settlement, the parties got into a dispute because the terms, at least two of the terms, are what started this off. Two of the terms transferred to my client the domain name, and my client transferred their Italian registration to Elio. Neither party did that, admittedly. Request for arbitration by both parties.
And can you answer Judge Posner's question when that happened?
It was in 2001, I believe the arbitrators were selected. Our briefing at record 80 and our briefing at record 65 lays out the case law and the timeline, so I believe it can be found in both of those records sites. The arbitration was each party selected their arbitrator. Each party filed a lawsuit.
Did you give a month? I do not know
the month, Your Honor. No. Each party filed a lawsuit.
You said it was in the record, page 80 or something?
Well, it's not in the appendix. It's actually at the record docket entry 60.
Okay, that's fine. Go ahead.
The parties both filed lawsuits. We vehemently disagree that this 1999 agreement created any U.S. trademark rights or assigned any trademark rights, and this was argued in both of those documents, the docket sites I just gave you. The district court had that in front of him. The district court had copious briefing on jurisdictional and stays and arbitration in front of it. It had all this evidence. And reviewing all that evidence, it determined that there were two lawsuits filed before the U.S. lawsuit was filed over here. Subsequent to the U.S. lawsuit being filed over here, Ilio runs and files another Italian lawsuit. And this is the first time ever in the record that you can find that Ilio stood up and said, I own U.S. trademark rights. I want to enforce them. And what does he do? He doesn't enforce them with the arbitration agreement. He enforces them with another lawsuit. The district court did not abuse its discretion or clearly err in finding that the arbitration provision had been waived.
Why do we think, just out of curiosity, that the concepts of the relation between an arbitration and a judicial proceeding that we have in the U.S., which are certainly, as you describe, are shared by the Italian courts? I mean, in Italy, if an arbitration clause exists in agreement and people are then litigating, do the Italian courts regard that as a waiver of arbitration?
You know, there's nothing in the record that says what that was, and I would say it's the burden on the appellee to have the appellant to have brought that to the attention of the district court, which it never did.
Now, is there a motion pending in the district court to supplement the record with the decision of the court of Ancona?
Yes. What happened was the appellant filed a motion to supplement here, but it didn't follow the court's rules, so it withdrew it. Filed in the district court,
right.
That motion's still pending.
That's
correct.
Still pending. Okay.
And I'll say, since it's brought up, what's interesting about that, maybe I shouldn't go into it because it's not part of the record. So
it's a judicial document.
What about the translation? This translation on page 10 of their brief. Did you accept the accuracy of it for purposes of our decision?
Absolutely not.
Do you have your own translation? What on earth are we supposed to do with warring translations?
The translation that my client that we submitted to the district court is found in the docket citation at 80 that I just gave you, I believe. I think it's also at 65.
But you don't discuss it in your... I don't recall your brief discussing the text of the arbitration clause.
No, where you'll find that, Your Honor, is in our motion to strike the affidavits.
Yeah, but I mean, in the briefs in this court, I didn't see anything about that.
No, you're right. It's not. Because, again, we're if you look at... And this kind of goes to the request for admissions that they only waited 4 months. That's not true. The request for admissions had jurisdictional questions in them about you sell your products into Chicago for personal jurisdiction purposes. So this red herring that, oh, we didn't have to respond and we're going to lie behind the log for a little while because it was jurisdictional first, that dog don't hunt. I just don't understand how you get there.
Let me ask you, and I'm disturbed by what the judge did with damages and attorney's fees. You can't add statutory damages to compensatory damages. That's impossible. And isn't that what he did, isn't that what was done?
No, I don't believe that's what was done, Your Honor. I think what happened was the district court had in front of it this evidence of lost profits. It's evidence of what has happened in this lawsuit. The district court had in front of it all of what was going on between the parties. It had.
Are you saying that the damages judgment is just compensatory?
Absolutely.
But that's not what the judge says. On page A007 of the brief, which is page 7 of the district judge's February 8 decision, he says, summary judgment with respect to damages is awarded in favor of plaintiff in the amount of $151,200 for lost profits. I award statutory damages, $500 per accordion, or $216,000, and then he goes on to attorney's fees and costs. So you can't come up with his number without adding the lost profits and the statutory damages. I don't know how else to read this.
I would say that at best, there's an ambiguity from the district court as to exactly what it did.
I don't see how can I find ambiguity in that when he calls it statutory damages, and then in the next document, which he also files, the order of judgment and injunction, he says that the Master Sound and Dita Gabinelli Ubaldo, Di Elio Gabinelli, are jointly and severally liable in the amount of $367,200.
I think it's because the phrase there, under the just circumstances of the case, which section 1117A gives the district court broad discretion
but
in awarding damages.
But not to disregard,
it's a choice. It's either statutory or... Now, you also awarded you $147,000 in attorney's fees. Now, what kind of documentation had you submitted on which he based his award of attorney's fees?
I submitted a declaration from myself from 2005 that had our client's attorney's fees up through that date, which was $147,000. So no attorney's fees were awarded from 2005 forward.
Well, was your did you show your hour? I mean, when you say a declaration, did you break it down?
Yes, Your Honor. If you look at starting on Appendix 247 is my declaration, and in it I explain how I came about the calculation of $147,000 in attorney's fees. It's actually on A250 to A251. And it was done by hourly multiplied by the work.
February 2008, he's awarding attorney's fees cut off in 2005?
That's correct. We never supplemented that the attorney's fees up through February of 2008.
Are you planning to or what?
We are going to consider that. I tell you the truth at this juncture, Your Honor, even if it were another $100,000 in attorney's fees, which wouldn't surprise me, we've got a defendant in Italy who has no assets at all in the United States. Why throw good money supplementing attorney's fees?
Well, that's a very strong point.
So the injunctive relief is what you seek primarily.
Well, the injunctive relief, absolutely. Injunctive relief is most important to us.
Yeah. Because there's no way an Italian court would recognize and enforce a U.S. judgment that conflicts with an Italian judgment.
I disagree.
Well, one can see, but you more or less said you didn't have much hope of that.
Well, yeah, it's going to be difficult. And again, you've got to ask yourself, do you want to spend the money to try? And you always have to take that into consideration in any pragmatic discussion or decision-making process.
Particularly since in civil law countries, they really have a whole different concept of discovery and personal jurisdiction and everything else.
There's definitely different laws. I will agree with that.
That's it.
We respectfully request that the district court be affirmed in all respects.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Matheny. And Mr. Borscher, your time expired. We'll give you a minute if you have anything further you'd like to say.
Thank you, Your Honor. It goes back to, I think, the issue of fairness here and the issue of getting to the merits of the case. There are definitely substantive issues that were before the district court that should have been considered. The affidavit of Elio Gabanelli, the documents we submitted, there were documents with his affidavit, but his testimony is sufficient enough in terms of the chain of title for the priority of use. The plaintiff in this case was a distributor of Gabanelli. And that's why they do not have trademark rights in the U.S. Even though they were selling here, they do not have trademark rights. And our client did present that.
I don't understand. I thought they say they design these things and they buy it, you know, from various manufacturers. We certainly have a trademark in
their
goods
trademarks
that, you know, are manufactured by someone else, obviously.
They even admit in the early years they only bought from us. And they were selling through us.
You know who us is, actually.
Elio Gabanelli.
Well, I don't understand that. You have this complicated familial relationship and company passing this brother and that brother.
Well, the Italian court has settled the issue in terms of, I mean, their decision was Elio is the proper owner, does have proper chain of title, and the defendant is actually an infringer because they did not have trademark rights. So that's the decision of the Italian court.
So you now this is the recent decision?
Yes.
So you have this recent decision that, right, after the argument. So, but you haven't submitted it to us.
Well, we tried to, but it is before the district court in terms of getting it to you, to supplement the record.
I understand. Why didn't you say, why you?
We filed the motion with the district court to supplement the record. We filed it with this court at first that they objected to it, and then we filed it with the district court, and the district court has it in front of them. They're objecting to the court seeing that document.
I see. So I see. But you would like the district court to consider it, and what?
Well, we would like the district court to supplement the record, to grant our motion to supplement the record.
What would you like the district court to do with this Italian decision?
Well, to
do you any good to have in the record. What is it you want to do with it?
To recognize, well, one thing the district court ruled is that the Italian court...
Yeah, what do you want to do in the district court? Do you want to... Suppose we affirm the district court judgment. Would you then, you know, file a Rule 60 motion to vacate it on the basis of this Italian decision, or what?
I'm not sure yet, Your Honor.
I thought as soon as the district court agreed to supplement the record, you could then take it back up to this court so that we would see...
That's what we plan to do.
What's in it.
Yes, that's what we plan to do.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Borscher and Mr. Matheny. Next case.